No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight, we're very, very excited to have a special guest with us, Carol Schwartz. Carol, I could read you Carol's resume, but that would take the whole hour. So we're just going to bring her on. She's somebody that anybody in the District of Columbia knows. She's been at the center of D.C. politics for more than 4 decades. She's run for mayor 5 times. She's been elected to the city council 4 times. She was on the Board of Education, elected to the Board of Education. And she's a great lady, and we're so excited to have her with us tonight to discuss her new book. She's just put a book out about her life in D.C. politics. So let's bring her on the show. Carol, are you there?
I'm here, and I'm glad to be with you, Michael, and you, Maria.
Thank you so much, Carol. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
So, Maria, Carol was a Republican, and now she's an independent. And I know you were excited to have her on the show because she was a long-term Republican, and we have a lot of Democrats on. So you want to ask her the first question?
I do. When did you decide to not have an R behind your name, and why?
Well, I started, actually became an R when I was about 8 years old. I remember handing out I Like Ike buttons at my elementary school in Midland, Texas. So I identified with the party when I was 8. It was at the age of 70, in fact, not 70, 69, that I left the R behind and became an independent. So it was a lot of years there that I was, 60 years that I was a Republican. But I found it harder and harder to belong to the Republican Party and to identify with it. It was just veering too far to the right for me. I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'm very proud of that fact. But socially, I'm a moderate to a liberal. And I hung in there for years, and it was a detriment to my mayoral elections, especially. Because, it's a D.C. is a town of 77% Democrats to 7% Republicans in those days. I think it's now 76%, always an 11-to-1 ratio. And so, obviously, it was very hard to get elected with an R next to your name. But I held on to the party for all those years because I think it's important to have a somewhat of a two-party system, even though at 11-to-1, it's kind of a joke of a two-party system. And number two, because Congress has oversight over the district, unfortunately, it was good to have at least one Republican who could go off up to the Hill and back off, or go to the White House and back off. Congress people, Republican Congress people, or presidents, who wanted to, get too much into our business and too much into our laws and budget. And so it was helpful to the district for me to be a Republican. I had been a proud Republican most of the years I was one. So I kept it, But when I became less and less proud to be one, and I wasn't in elected politics anymore, so I couldn't use it as a helper to be for legislation and such. I wasn't in elected office. I just decided I'm going to be what I really feel these days, and that's independent. So four years ago this month, I became an independent.
Well, let me just comment on that for a second, that I went up to the Hill one time with the mayor and with Councilwoman Schwartz and a bunch of other people, and we were standing in the anteroom for the House floor, and I want to tell you, every Republican that came off the floor hugged Carol Schwartz. Every Republican in Congress knew her. And you were a real asset as a Republican, because you had been a Republican and the only Republican really for so long in D.C. that every Republican member of Congress knew who you were, Carol. So that was a reason.
Thank you, Mike, for noticing, Michael, for noticing that. But I do think it was helpful to the city. As I said, I think it was a detriment to me politically. Had I just become an independent in one of those races, one of those earlier races, it may have made a difference in my desire to be mayor. But I also always thought that if these, and I got a lot of Democratic votes. I mean, one election I got as much as 42% of the vote when I was, a registration entitled to about 7%. And of course, that didn't mean every Republican would vote for me, because we're liberal for some. But I came close, but I thought if I could ever make it, I thought it could be very helpful in getting us those voting rights that Michael Brown and so many others have led us, for many years now to get. And I, certainly have tried to do good efforts, in my 52 years in the city. So I thought, gosh, if we'd be smart enough to elect a Republican, I can go up there and I can take away that whole issue. Come on, folks. These people in this town, Democratic town, elected this Republican. Now give us what we deserve and pay for and do it now. And I thought it would make a big difference in that argument.
That would have made a huge impression, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think so, too, because our problem is certainly a partisan problem.
Well, and Carol, I define myself exactly as you did when you were a Republican, and most of my Republican friends are far more conservative than I am, certainly socially, and I keep saying to them, there has to be room under this tent that has left-leaning folks and right-leaning folks, or else we're going to become obsolete.
I agree. And it's one of the reasons I also hung on. I hung on because it was helpful, as I mentioned, to the district. And I was able, like when a Republican member of Congress put a rider on that said no single person adoptions. And, of course, we know that was really targeted at, lesbian and gay, the transgender community. And I went up there. I was able to get an appointment. And I was able to go up there with some other, advocates like myself. And I just started talking about my friends who had adopted children in need of a loving home. And I started crying. Now, I can't cry normally on demand. I mean, but I started crying just talking about these homes and how these children would suffer if people couldn't adopt them, such as my friends. And the next day, the rider disappeared. So I could be helpful in that way. But I also hung in, just like you said, Maria, because I thought, a big tent. It used to be a big tent. And why shouldn't the party of Lincoln be a big tent? But right. I felt very isolated in that big tent. I also continued to give some money to... I'm not talking thousands, but a few $100 each year to Main Street, Amy Houghton Group that really looked to keep moderate Republicans in office, running for office and in office.
But well, you should.
Know, I think right now, I hate to say it, but I think it's becoming a lost cause, and I hate to say it because I don't think a one-party system is good for any of us, any of us.
Mm-hmm. No, it's certainly not good for any of us. And, you know, I would say, as somebody that was in 35 years in politics, there used to be a lot of Republicans that I admired, not so many anymore. But, you know, in your case, Carol, the Republican Party did what I consider a really dumb thing with you in running Patrick Mara against you in a primary, Maria, in which only 4,000 people voted. In the whole city, only 4,000 voted in a primary. Where Carol was unseated. And then she went up to, against, then he went up against the guy that Carol would have beat with no problem. Let me tell you, they would have, so they effectively got rid of the only Republican they had. And that seemed to me to be crazy. What don't you think it was, Carol?
I do. But you know what? I can't really, Michael, blame the party, because let me tell you, in that primary, and, you know, the party's not supposed to, the Republican Party or any party's not supposed to endorse anybody
right.
in a primary. But because it was such a targeted thing, Maria, I had given led the way in giving sick leave to workers and in private employment. There had been a bill introduced similar to one out in San Francisco that gave sick leave to workers. We're not talking government workers, but private sector workers. And I didn't even sign on. There's 13 members of the council. The only person the first day who did not sign on of those 13 members was me. Because even though I kind of like the philosophy of subsidizing the working poor, you know, these are part-time workers that weren't getting even one day of sick leave, for example. And so I like the idea, but it was too extreme. It would have hurt our small businesses especially. And so I didn't sign on the first day, but 12 members of the council, the other 12 members signed on. But then it came to my committee, and of course I'm sure they put it in my committee since I didn't sign on, because then they hoped it would stay in my committee and die off. They'd all get the credit of having supported it and signed on, and then, of course, Big Bad Carol would have killed it off. And I'm capable of killing off things. I've done it to plenty in my career that probably needed killing off. But this one, I saw the benefit. So I had to, it caused my defeat, but I need to give a little background if y'all will just bear with me a minute.
Yeah, please.
But because I liked the idea of it, I did bring the 26 organizations, all very progressive organizations. It was unions. It was the Fiscal Policy Institute. You know, it was just all these 26 groups. 20 actually came for an evening meeting that I had, not even in my office. I had it in one of the conference rooms downstairs in our, you know, quote, city hall. And anyway, I sat there and I said, listen, I want to give you some sick leave. I think it's a good idea. I think it's important, especially when I found out that the major drug companies, you know, that are the, you know, they're like the richest people around, that they 51% of their workers were part-time. Now, why are they part-time? We know the answer to that. So they don't have to get any sick leave, any vacation time, any anything. They just go to work and work and get their hourly wage, and that's it. Poor them. And it's awful. And anyway, so I sat down with them, and I said, listen, folks, I'm willing to work on this bill, but it's going to be a shadow of what you gave us. It's going to be a shadow of its former self, but I will give you some sick leave. But you won't necessarily recognize the bill you introduced, but I'm going to do it. But I have no intentions of putting the time, the energy, and maybe even my career into this. And then have you, after it leaves my committee, start piling on all the stuff that I took off and changed. And I looked at every single one of them. I said, but I'm willing to do it if you promise, commit not to do that. Now, that never happened in my, you know, all those years of service, 24 years in elected political life in D.C., never happened where I looked him in the eye and I said, commit. I went around the room and every single one of the 20 promised that once it left my committee, they would not bring back the pylon. And then I said, then I need to know these six who are not present today, I need to know of their commitment as well. And they called me a day or two later and said they all have committed. Now, this is all verbal. It's not written. You know, I could have been done in a second. But you know what? They never strayed. So I went about then working with the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, the Board of Trade, the Hospital Association, all the groups that had, you know, interest in this bill, and tried to get their legitimate concerns. And I had some legitimate concerns myself about the small businesses, but I tried to get all the legitimate concerns. And I didn't give them all their legitimate concerns, but I compromised in various areas. And we put together a bill that by right before, you know, the holidays in December, and this is December of 2007, I got a unanimous vote by the committee. The Chamber of Commerce put out a press release that day that we really got a great compromise bill. It, you know, really took in the concerns of the business community, and the chair of the committee worked so well with us. We're so happy. And so I thought we're well on our way. And then over the holidays, the garage guys and gals, you know, the ones that have the private parking lots, they, you know, who only have part-time workers, they went ballistic. And then they started getting the restaurant people and everybody else all revved up. So by the time we came back in January, the business community was fit to be tied, and they started putting packs together, you know, so they could spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars were raised to target me, to get rid of me, to show that, you know, nobody's going to, you know, the person who's doing this to us, we're going to punish her to such a degree that nobody will try anything like it this again. So it really wasn't the party. It was some members of the business group. And there were just a few of them, but they put enormous amounts of money in. And they joined together with a colleague who wanted me gone. And so it really wasn't the Republican Party. Actually, the Republican Party saw what was happening to me, and they did a highly unusual thing. They endorsed me in the primary, and they spent money and time and advertising and everything to try to get me elected. But because of these PAC groups spending buku kind of money, and there were 17 push polls that went into every single Republican household. There were 13 gigantic mailings, you know, saying I was a tax and spend, you know, crazy person, even though, Michael, you remember me, I was the biggest fiscal conservative on the council. And yeah. And I'm the one that was always working to lower taxes. So it was just one lie after another lie. But because, and then they also ran around and got all, you know how we have so many universities in town? Mm-hmm. They ran around to all the universities except for UDC and Howard for obvious reasons. But they ran around to, you know, American University and GW and Georgetown, and they got all the young Republicans to register to vote. They said, look at this young man, a conservative running for office as a Republican against this crazy liberal woman, old woman who's giving sick leave to workers. And so it was those voters, those new Republicans, young Republicans from the universities who didn't even live in D.C. other than be, you know, at a dormitory,
students,
that,
right,
that made the difference in that election. But the party itself, God bless them, hung in with me. But then when I lost the primary, the national party said, all right, we put up with your endorsing someone in the primary. Now you cannot have anything to do with her. You've got to back him. So I just wanted to straighten that out.
Yeah, and it's just crazy. For those of you that aren't Washingtonians, Carol was just a wildly popular person. Understand that all these things that she's just explained to you work so well because there were only 4,000 people that actually went out to vote. So if you spend a lot of money and you send out a lot of mailings and you do the stuff that you just outlined, Carol, to a handful of people, it can be very effective. And the guy that
That's
ran,
right. I only got, lost by a couple of hundred votes, but yeah. But it made all the difference. I came back and waged a Maria a write-in campaign and actually got more votes as a write-in than the person who defeated me in the primary got.
Yeah.
But
did you really?
I did, and that gave me some little bit of satisfaction. But it was not enough to beat the person who was a Democrat turned independent, who was the son of Ron Brown, a very well-known African-American, had been a member of Clinton's cabinet and also had run several times before, switched from Democrat to independent just very soon before the election. So he had good name recognition because of his father and because of former races where he had not won but had campaigned a lot. And he also drew number one on the ballot. How's that for bad luck?
What a pedigree, huh?
And he got 19% of the vote.
He won
19% of the vote.
How is that possible?
Well, because you vote for two.
Not beat him, but at least I beat the guy, I think who was a put-up guy, by that group I was talking about. At least I beat him, and that gave me some satisfaction. But meanwhile, my career was over.
Well, and like I say, he got 19% of the vote. The time that you ran before that and got elected, you did much better than that. So the idea
that... Yeah, I did.
That,
I got 94,000 votes the time before.
Right. Right, when you ran for mayor. Yeah, but that leads me to my next question, Carol. Since I've been elected, okay, we've seen just horrible corruption in the District of Columbia. The guy you just talked about went to jail for taking bribes from the FBI. Kwame Brown, the chairman of the council, resigned. Harry Thomas took money, who was a councilman, took money stole money from the Little League. We have a mayor who a guy that was mayor who had five people on his campaign resign and plead guilty to crimes. I don't ever remember any of that. Anybody saying anything about you? How did you last in politics for 4 decades in Washington with all this stuff going on around you? I find
well,
that
listen, you know, it was never an easy job, but it was a job I loved and cared about. And I also tried to stop some of the shenanigans that were going on. I mean, I always unearthed deals where, you know, even under Williams' administration, there were, you know, they were just crazy deals with Doug Jamal and all. And I really kind of stepped in and unearthed those. And I kept trying to make these things seen and heard and known about, because I thought that could stop it. You know, when people saw that somebody was being a watchdog and was minding the store, that it would change things. And it did for a while, and then people would get back to their old ways, unfortunately. But I think that the more you you do strong oversight and unearth, the less that goes on. Now, I thought the earmarks were terrible, and people, that's how a lot of that stuff got done,
right,
was by using earmarks, and in some cases to non-existent charities. And so I really did speak up about earmarks, but I couldn't prevail. But I never shut up about it. You know, even I would just keep, you know, beating the old same old drum, but they should have been listening to me, that's for sure, because they got in trouble.
Non-existent charities?
Excuse me? Yeah,
non-existent
that happened too.
Charities?
Yeah, that they would do earmarks for, you know, or just kind of like charities that were name only.
That's terrible.
Terrible.
Well, no, I know. But earmarks, you any government, Maria, just should be careful about earmarks, because all they are they're non-competitive. You know how I'm very much against non-competitive contracts. You know, like, hey, buddy, come and get it. Mm-hmm. I really think government needs to decide what services or what it needs done, and then put out bids and come people come in, and that it be an open, honest process.
Mm-hmm.
And earmarks are just non-competitive bids. You know, I mean, grants. They're just, hey, buddy, come and get it.
And we've seen this happen several times since Carol's left. I got to tell you, we've had situations where the school food contract was in your, you know, was given without competition, and people were fired over it, and all sorts of other things. So this is still going on in D.C.
Oh, it is. But let me tell you, D.C., I don't think is, Michael, we're talking about D.C. now because that's what we know about. I'm telling you, it goes on in governments all over the country, all over the world. It's just that wherever people aren't doing their watchdog role they should be doing, it can happen anywhere, and it does happen anywhere.
Yeah, I'm sure.
How do you know that there's an opportunity and that it has or hasn't been offered for bids? Because I would think that comes out after the fact, not before.
Well, it doesn't always come out after the fact. I think if you do, as an elected official, really strong oversight and ask questions, number one. Number two, every jurisdiction should have a very strong whistleblowers protection law. And I made sure we had the strongest in the country, because people knew I was, you know, open and honest and about good government. They would come to me to tell me things. But of course, you've got to make sure that your whistleblower protection law doesn't protect people that are being moved on to be fired. You know, and so I made sure that anybody who was being moved on to be fired couldn't all of a sudden start blowing the whistle on the boss who's about to fire them without any really real credibility. So, you know, you have to separate the wheat from the chaff in a way. But my office always said we welcomed hearing from legitimate whistleblowers that really had something to tell us. And if they could come in and be safe, and then you could try to check on it, that's a big help. Who knows better what's going on in government than the workers there? And right. So we did the strongest whistleblowers protection law in the country. Even the federal government used ours as a model. But you also have to make sure that an employee that's on the way out the door doesn't cloak him or herself in your law. If they're already, you know, on probation or halfway out the door, they can't all of a sudden become a whistleblower conveniently. But that's a good hedge against it. And then do hearings and bring in people, and, you know, we have the ability to subpoena even. You know, we have to get that ability from our colleagues. We don't have it just willy-nilly. And then you can find out. And listen, when you start punishing that kind of bad behavior by outing it, it goes away for a while. And then I think, unfortunately, some of the bad guys in government forget or think, well, why not try again? You know, we laid low for a while. Let's rear our ugly head again.
It worked before.
Yeah, it worked before.
Well, you know, as you pointed out, Carol, I'm sorry, you fought for a lot of good causes. And the thing that jumped out at me in your bio when I read it, the one thing that I didn't know about you, is that you were born in Mississippi and raised in Midland, Texas, That must have been not easy for a Jewish girl in the 1950s.
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy, and but in a way, and I hope I just brought out several weeks ago my autobiography, which is called, as you all mentioned earlier, Quite a Life, From Defeat to Defeat, ... and back. And and it speaks of defeats because there were some political, that last council race that we just talked about. There were, as Michael mentioned, five mayoral races. That you can, one, I want to tell people that it's okay to be defeated. It's better than not trying. It's better to lose than not try. And then number two, I also had a lot of personal defeats, including a childhood that had a very tough father. My only brother was an individual with intellectual disabilities who was a year and a half older, who I took care of since I was about five. My parents had a mama papa little store, and I worked in that store and had to work in that store starting at the age of eight. And we lived in a town where there were only a couple of Jewish families, and I got a lot of junk that came with that. And all of those experiences, very difficult, very hard to talk about. Very little pleasure except when I'd flee to Mississippi to be with my grandparents for the month of August with my mother and my brother. Those were the, you know, shining light times of my childhood. The rest was pretty horrific. But I wanted to tell my story because I thought it would make people realize that you don't have to have everything handed to you. That you can actually even have, not only not have things handed to you, but have huge obstacles in your way and overcome them. And that I think it's, you know, a life lesson that I wanted to impart. And I did it. And I'm excited that I did it. Now, it's a long book. It's got lots of pictures, though, 48 pages of pictures. But it really tells a life story. It also, in fact, let me read the back of the book, which I think really kind of does it best. Always a straight shooter, Carol, that's me, talks about her life with characteristic candor and her opinions with unbridled honesty, and usually with humor. From her difficult childhood in West Texas to her unexpected political victories to her losses both in public and private life, including the sudden death of her husband, Carol Schwartz tells it like it was, warts and all. As Carol says, if you want someone to give you a sugar-coated synopsis of a life, go elsewhere. But if you want an outspoken, personal autobiography with pictures galore that also talks about the history of D.C. since home rule, takes you behind the scenes of chaotic campaigns, as well as shows you the inner workings of government, all row together, come on this ride with me. It's a journey of wins and defeats and coming back with hope. So it's a long book because I tried to get everything in it, including my ruminating the last few years about the state of the world today, not necessarily D.C., but just the state of the world today.
Well, first of all, let me say, since you brought up Ride Along with Carol, let me tell you how disappointed I am that I learned that you sold the yellow convertible. Is that true?
No, that it's not true. Okay. Are you kidding? It's parked in my garage downstairs right this minute.
All right. Who started that rumor, Michael?
I don't know, but thank God.
You know, probably the same people that said I live in Rehoboth, even though I have a little getaway place there. Yeah. There are always little things that are not true. No, I have that yellow. Are you kidding?
Thank goodness.
I love that car.
Because it's a...
Maria,
it's
it was my midlife crisis
cool
gift to myself. What?
Well, it works well, let me tell you. It looks good. And I'd like your opinion on the world today, because I know you're the mother of three children. I happen to know your daughter, Hillary. I got to know Hillary by standing next to her in the District of Columbia. You have to get signatures to get on the ballot. And Hillary and I stood together outside the Department of Motor Vehicles for many, many days
really?
During the last election. Yes. And Hillary's a lovely young woman. You should be very proud of her, Carol. I'm sure you are.
Oh, I really am. And, I think she's fabulous. And, you know, she helped me with this book. She actually... Hillary's a stand-up comic in New York, and
she's good.
Hillary was fun.
You should look at her on YouTube. She's good. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, she's just terrific. But she had, you know, to try to make a living in New York on as a stand-up comic, where every comic from all over the country comes, is very difficult, especially New York prices. And so she's had part-time jobs for years. And but then a few years ago, I said to her, I knew she didn't like her job. I said, "Do you want to come help me with this book?" And she said, "Yes." And so we've really not only, you know, worked on the campaign together, but also she was enormously helpful with getting this book completed. It took several years. So, but I also have two other children. I have a daughter who's it's called a referee, but it's not a, it's more like a magistrate judge in New York. She's a 15 and a half months older than Hillary, and she's in Manhattan Family Court, and a wonderful, wonderful advocate for abused and neglected children. She used to work for New York Legal Aid with prisoners. She's, you know, just an extraordinary woman, too. And then I have a son who's lives in California, and he's quite something. He's a singer, songwriter, musician, photographer, author, and also a Fulbright scholar, and has a master's degree from the London School of Economics and International Relations. So I really do have three extraordinary kids.
Wow.
Yeah, you
wow.
really do.
My brother graduated from the London School of Economics. About 15 years ago.
Oh, that's great. That's a hard school to get into.
Yeah. I understand they only accept two from every country or something.
Oh, really?
Every year?
I didn't even know that. It was really, you know, something, but he really is he's an artist in his soul, and he's, you know, chosen to pursue that area instead of other things.
But did you raise your family in D.C. then?
In D.C., and they all went to the D.C. public schools, only to the D.C. public schools.
Huh.
It certainly made for an interesting group.
And yeah. You should share your website, because that's how people can buy your book, right?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Maria. It's caroldc.com. Carol, C-A-R-O-L, no E, C-A-R-O-L-D-C. .com. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Because the reviews are
really
pretty spectacular. 745 pages.
And you know what? You can buy it locally too at Politics and Prose and other places.
About
Why don't you tell us? Because we have a lot of local listeners. Carol, what other stores besides Politics and Prose?
Boys and Poets.
Politics
and Prose. And Prose. Bridge Street in Georgetown. Upshur Street. And Ward 4, then Walls of Books. On Capitol Hill, it's at Capitol Hill Books. It's at East End Books. So we've got, you know, a bunch of bookstores that are carrying it. And it's
good
nice
for you.
To shop in those bookstores because, you know, it's a twofer, you know. You know, you buy my book and you help out a small business in D.C. Kramer's in D.C. hasn't taken my book, though. You know, there's a lot of young people there. They've actually not been very cooperative or even pleasant. So that's where I've always shopped, but that's where I used to shop.
Yeah, I guess so. So what do you think about the politics today, Carol? What do you think about... what's going on? I mean, I really would love the opinion of a woman who was a Republican for so many years, but accepted by so many Democrats. You cannot get elected in Washington, D.C. if the Democrats don't vote for you. So in this era when we're so divided, where everything just seems to be partisan, what can we do to come together, do you think?
Well, I think, I don't know, one, we usually look to our political people to lead us, and they, I mean, the lack of civility these days is, to me, is so, so maddening. And, you know, because if you look at the old days, there were, people were friends, I mean, like Orrin Hatch and,
right.
And you know, Kennedy, they were best friends. And then yeah. You've got, you know, there were lots of people like that. And like Reagan was very friendly with Tip O'Neill. I mean, there were people that had very close relationships, and they may not have agreed on the issues, but there was not only civility, there was actual friendship. And now you have very little of this. And it's, I think it makes it very, very difficult. I talk in the book, and I shouldn't really mention this necessarily because it may be too little of a point, but, you know, when everybody now, the media wants open government this, open government that, they want to be in on every meeting, two or three people can't sit and talk without having the media present, totally be an open meeting, and I talk about this in the book, that it's very hard for relationships to form if you can't ever sit down and talk. And that doesn't mean they should be doing real wheeling and dealing all in private. It's our personal, you know, public policy. But I do think that some discussions and compromises make for usually better government, better laws, and more civility. And so I think we've gone to an extreme in a way.
Yeah, and Maria and I have had a civility expert actually on the show, because I think we both agree with you on that point. And
doesn't it always boil down to relationships? I mean,
everything.
Yeah, I don't care what you're talking about, politics or business or neighborhoods or councils or city government or county government. It's really about relationships. And when you see a person and it's not just something on paper, there's emotions that get involved. And I'm not saying I'm not talking romance. I'm just saying it becomes human. And that's where I think that we've gotten so polarized that we don't realize that the other side is a human being that has fears and failures and all of those things that all of us experience as a human race. And if we could have more empathy, I think we could have more sympathy, and then therefore we could have more compromise.
No, I think that was beautifully said, because I do think that it's the relationships that I made both on the school board and the council that didn't compromise my principles or my thoughts on what should be done, but it also made me work with the other side far more civilly, and it also helped us sit down, because I've said everything in the book, that's why it's so darn long, is because I did say everything that I ever wanted to say. I don't think I ever have to say another word. If everybody read my book, I'd never have to say another word. But I did talk so much about how if we were debating a subject, you know, like it's certainly an emotional subject of some sort. If somebody walked out of my office, like high five, you know, boy, we got our way, you know, we're just so happy. And then the other side walked out devastated. I knew I didn't do my job. Because
so well said.
I do think, other than bigotry, which I'd never compromise on, you know, bigotry's bad. I won't say anything that I would not compromise bigotry. But if it's not bigotry, there are usually at least two sides to every issue, sometimes five sides to every issue. So I would try to take the best of all five sides and work out something that would be a compromise.
Which is a win-win-win.
Which is a win-win-win-win. And, right. And why not?
Right.
Why should some one side get it all and the other side gets nothing if they have legitimate issues? And it's not based on something like bigotry. You know, I don't think you compromise on your distaste of bigotry. So I think that there's so much that could be done. I think the civility experts you all brought on, you know, let's pay them to go meet with Congress. I mean, yeah. And the president. Oh, God, the president. We would need about 12 people, I'm afraid.
Well, and, you know, just so you understand that Carol knows of what she speaks, I can tell you that when we were getting signatures at the DMV and Carol would show up, everybody wanted to talk to Carol. She knew everybody in the place.
Hog my book there.
Yeah, you know
what?
You
everybody, you know, it was like we're like, oh, no, here comes Carol. Time to go home. Okay, see you, Hillary. Have fun. Because everybody ran to Carol.
That's sweet of you, Michael. Well, Carol, do you talk about the being a single mom in the book?
I do. I mean, you know, my kids were teenagers when I lost my husband, so I didn't really have to totally raise them on my own. But you know, I think what led up to his, you know, departure, you know, often had him, you know, going to bed early, and he suffered from depression, and but he was a great dad. I mean, whatever energy he had, and was the kids were number one to him. And he also, you know, he was a marvelous lawyer in private practice, and went from being a poor boy from the Bronx to being very successful. But it was still doing what needed to be done, and that was therapy. Of course, this was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. It wasn't right. What most people did. You know, it was a stigma about it if it happened.
And suffered in silence.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He suffered in silence, and he unfortunately went to alcohol as his medication, and alcohol is actually a depressant. It can actually make things worse. So it was just, you know, one of those just very sad things. But
I'm sorry.
But so the kids really were basically raised by the time I became a single mother. But I certainly tried to do all I could to get them through a horrible time. I left the council, actually. I waited till my term expired, but I did choose not to run again so I could spend some time on my own healing as well as be there for my kids during their time. But it was very hard, very hard. But
I can't imagine. I'm so sorry.
No, it is. It's. Yeah, thank you. But listen, it happens far more than we know. I found once we went through the horror of that it was so many people that came, and there was a love fest. I mean, people just came. I mean, there must have been 1,000 people through my house. There were probably 1,500 at the funeral. It was really something. So many people that hugged me were people I had known for years that I never knew this about. They would say their mother had committed suicide, their father, their brother, their first husband. It is far more prevalent than we think. It's just that most of the time it is described as cardiac arrest in the newspaper.
Is it?
Yeah.
You know, now that you're saying that, I've got a handful of clients that I work with that their parents, one or the both, did.
Yeah.
I never really thought about it until you put it into that perspective.
But yeah, when you read it in the paper, I talked about this in the book too, then when you read it in the paper, like someone died similarly to David, my husband, a few months later, and it was cardiac arrest in the paper. And so I think that, and not that we, I just think when you go through it, you're so lonely, you think you're the only person in the world it ever happened to, when actually it happens to lots of people. You just don't know about it. And so it's, you know, I just wish it would stop happening. I just wish people that need help would go seek it and not in drugs and alcohol, which are, I mean, some drugs are fine. You know, meds that are prescribed drugs are fine.
Right.
But
right.
But those that just try to self-medicate only do more harm to themselves than good. I think I've seen not only in my husband's case, but in other cases.
Well, ironically, they say that folks who do harm themselves, it's because they're coming out of the depression that's crushing and debilitating, and they don't ever want to go back there again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, so they see this glimmer of hope that they might actually get out of it. And then they think, if I ever go back there, I can't live. And so I'd rather not. And of course, men are completers. Women attempt, but men complete in general.
Yeah. No, my husband never talked. It also never said a word, never talked about it. Whereas they also say the people that never, you know, threatened or said anything. I mean, I never even thought that would happen. I had a father that said he was going to do it all the time, and he never did, and a husband who said not a word and did. Sometimes you say, why me, Lord? But listen, I've had lots of blessings, too. So,
wow.
It all
Wow. You are such an inspiration. Michael,
Let me just say that we're running out of time here. I still have about 10,000 questions that I want to ask you, so you'll have to come back again. But
and
I want to tell you,
745 pages of answers.
Right, and if you need a good Hanukkah gift or a Christmas present, or just want to give an inspirational story about somebody that's seen it all. I mean, come on, from Greenville, Mississippi, to the top of the heap in DC politics. This is a story that I can't wait to finish reading. And I think everybody out there should read it. So one more time, Carol, before we let you go, tell us what that website is.
It's CarolDC.com, CarolDC.com. And it has, you know, how you can buy the book. And it also talks about anybody that lives in Washington, D.C., or the metropolitan area. It talks about events. And so you can get a lot of knowledge about what's going on with this whole book release just from that website. But I certainly appreciate coming on and being able to talk about it. And, of course, you can invite me back, and we'll continue talking about one of the things I know that's so near and dear to your heart, Michael, and that is the lack of voting representation in the United States Congress, that the District of Columbia, 681,000 residents pay for in the form of federal income taxes. And we are entitled to it. It's not going to be a gift from anybody. It's something we are entitled to, and something that, as you say, is 200 years old injustice that needs to be rectified, and the sooner the better.
Well, and that'll be the beginning of our next conversation. So we'll have you again soon. Thank you so much for coming. Carol, wish you and your family, your two lovely daughters and your son, a great holiday season, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you both. And Maria, it was so nice to get to know you in this fashion. If you ever come to D.C., give me a call. I'm listed in the phone book.
I'm going to hold you to it. Carol,
okay,
thank
perfect.
You. Right. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And then, Michael, I wanted to thank you for arranging that. What a story. What a life. I'm very, very
interested. We really just scratched the surface. We really have just scratched the surface.
But let's promote our guest for next week, because she says most affairs start at the holiday parties. And she has do's and don'ts and a cheating predictor cheat sheet. seat to see if you or your partner is ripe for an affair and temptation. So she's a PhD and love and relationship expert, Dr. Bonnie Eaker Wheel. So I thought that was timely for us right before
So let's reach out to everyone in Hollywood and every member of Congress
and Sacramento.
You should listen in next week to this show. But thanks for listening, America. We're going to go out with a song tonight and dedicate it to our guest, Carol Schwartz, I'm a Survivor by Destiny's Child. And we'll see you next week with Dr. Bonnie.
That's
thanks.
Right. Goodbye. Have a great week.
Yeah.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.